All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters, what the fuckadelics? How's it going? This is Mark Maron. This is WTF, my podcast. Thank you for listening. Welcome to the show. If you're new to the show, glad to have you. What's happening? I don't know where you're listening, but I hope everything's going okay. All right? We've got a pretty amazing show today. Centra Wilson, the amazing, brilliant cultural critic and writer, has just written a new book. Well, it's been out a little bit. It's called Fear and Clothing, Unbuckling American Style. It's available anywhere you get books. That's happening. She's going to be here. I love her. I haven't talked to her in a long time. Last time I talked to her was in New York. It's always an amazing conversation. Very funny, very smart, exciting. It was exciting. Also, what else is going on with me? Talking about reading. If you never read my book, Attempting Normal, there's a special right now for the next 2 weeks. It's on sale for $1.99 everywhere ebooks are sold. $1.99. That's a real ego boost. Everywhere ebooks are sold. So go do that. Get Attempting Normal right now. There's a special for the next couple weeks if you have not read that. All right? And also, what else? Zach Valifagakis? Yes, Zach Valifagakis dropped by the garage the other day. Always nice to see Zach. I've not seen him since I talked to him. Maybe I ran into him a couple times, but he was on a very early WTF, and he's got a new show produced by Louis C.K., who I also got to spend some time with, not here on the mics, but we went out and had a nice meal, me and the Louis. The show that they co-created, it's called Baskets, premieres tonight on FX with new episodes coming at you every Thursday. So that was fun to talk to Zach. So it's a pretty packed show, and I'm kind of tired. We have begun production of Maron Season 4. And I got to tell you, man, the first 2 days went great. On this block, got a lot of the same crew back there. All the writer guys are there. Joe Kessler's on the camera. Lynn Shelton, the amazing Lynn Shelton, is directing the first two episodes. I've never worked with her as a director. It's been phenomenal. And it's, I got to admit, it's pretty funny. It might be the funniest season. It's a bit dark. It's going to be a show not like the show you saw before, in a way. It's a completely new show. I'll say again, for those of you who have kept up with Maron, you can see it on Netflix now, all of them. I think you can see all three seasons. At the end of season three, things were not great for the character of Maron. So we start there. We start a year here. Here's what I'll give you. We start a year after that last episode of Maron on season three. So it's a year later from whatever might have happened starting the day after that finale. All right, that's what I'll tell you. That could go either way, but think it through, make your assumptions. All the scripts will look real good. We got them all done before I started shooting because it was important to do that because I don't really have time to be rewriting on set. And I require less grooming this year. That's another hint that I'm going to give you. And that's all I'm going to say. I don't want to say any more other than I'm heavily employed right now. And of course we do the podcast throughout the shoot. So you know, I squeeze it in, have some conversations with some people, get on the mic here. But I'm a little exhausted. I'll tell you how exhausted I am. Last night I got back from the shoot. I was sitting there having a bowl of cereal and my two cats, Monkey and LaFonda, were on the couch. And I said, hey, you two fuckers. And they looked up at me at the same time, and I laughed for a little while. Tired, punchy. That's where I'm at. That got me going. That was all it took. Yeah. Also, Glenn Frey died, and he was in the Eagles. And I know a lot of people that kind of are like, the Eagles. And I think one of the reasons some of us think that is because we've heard the Eagles a lot. But I got to be honest with you, some of those songs, like the song Take It to the Limit, somewhere in there, like maybe with with Stairway to Heaven and a couple others, I think I was one of my first slow dances. And that has a profound impact. There, you always heard the Eagles all through your life. And this guy was a great songwriter, a good singer, and a great guitar player. I mean, it was just, it's to the point where I don't even really know how classic rock stations are going to do a tribute to the Eagles, because every other song is generally an Eagles song. That's how many hit songs they had. But it's a sad thing, and I do want to give him and them their props, because a couple of those songs were pretty powerful in the mind of a junior high kid back in the 70s. And that, so RIP, Glenn Frey. Anyways, Zach Galifianoodles, Zach Galifianaki, Zach Galifianakis co-created the show Baskets with Louis C.K., and he dropped by. We talk about a lot of stuff. So this is me and Zach Galifianakis. No, I know comics have a need to, you know, to keep, to do something. Do you know what that is? I mean, you seem to have managed to...
I'm good. I'm with you. I'm like... Necessarily. I don't like to do... I like my life better than my profession.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think I need to get there. I don't know if I'm quite there because I don't know what my life looks like. I mean,
I think people come to this town and they get hijacked by this way you're supposed to live your entertainment life.
Yeah.
It's not attractive to me whatsoever.
Has it ever been?
No. Going to the Sky Bar and whatever people do.
It's good to see you. I feel like I immediately felt when we saw each other at the front door after you kicked over the cat bowl. That,
well, why do you put your cat bowl right in the
walk
path?
It's a wild cat. It's like, it's not really my cat.
Oh, you know, it's a feral.
It's a feral that, you know, I feed out there. But I know it's a problem, and I apologize for that. But I felt right away that we're getting along better.
Oh, but you always, you always have this thing with people, I think, Mark.
No, just with you sometimes.
With me only?
No.
You don't think we get along?
No, I know we get along, but sometimes, sometimes I've, and maybe it's true, in the past, maybe this happened. If you knew you were going to do this, maybe in the past you'd be like, oh, I got to, okay, go talk to Mark.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, but that's your own insecurities, right?
Yeah.
I feel like that for people, too. I feel like, oh, shoot, someone has to come talk to me. I feel bad for them.
No, I think that sometimes I've been unnecessarily bitchy, but I feel better now. I'm just telling you that at the outset.
Well, I always liked, and I think your, if you want to call it whatever, anger, was always so funny.
Yeah.
And...
Right, makes me want to do it with you.
Well, anger makes me laugh. Like, I don't... It just does. It always has.
That's why I liked it.
But you and I have I look up to you.
I look up to you too. It took me a while, but I think I think you're funny.
It takes a while. It takes a while to like me.
But there was this one time, and maybe I should
say it. Because I wonder if I know what you're talking about.
But I wonder if I might have covered it like years ago when we did. You actually were one of the first. Yeah, I got to thank you. I mean, your podcast that we did in Albuquerque was really one of the essential ones towards building an audience. So I appreciate that.
Well, you know, I love to build podcasts.
Yeah, I know you do. From the ground up.
Marcel Marceau's podcast.
A lot of people aren't getting that.
No.
It's because it's weird.
It's just one person. It's just me going, you're skateboarding now?
Wait,
he doesn't say anything.
You're in a box.
I know you're pulling something. What is it?
No, but there was one time that I always felt bad about. Well, it was not even about bad. It was like it was at the old Largo,
mm-hmm.
And I didn't live here, and I was bitchy, and mm-hmm. You know, I was here, and I was going to go do this dumb set at this dumb club where everyone's doing these cool things.
Uh-huh.
And it was in that right by the door, like before you go on stage.
Right.
And I think you were wearing like a George Washington outfit. Uh-huh. You had
a get up.
It was a get, but it was a full get up. You'd gone to you'd outfitted yourself. You were a founding father or something.
I was a stand up comic from the 1700s.
Oh, all right. And there was just this beat where I walk in, you look at me, you're about to go on stage. And I was just sort of like, really? It takes that much? You're going
to. I know. Look, I'm not. Above doing prop humor, I don't.
But I felt bad about that because it was funny, and I could not see the funny at the time.
Well, you know, you're the first stand-up I ever met.
In the laundromat.
In the laundromat in North Carolina, yeah.
Yeah, it was a weird thing. I don't even know, like, in retrospect, I'm not sure why I was there. Had I been away that long to where I needed to wash clothes? I mean, it didn't pack properly.
No, it was in North Carolina.
I know.
And you were doing Charlie Goodnights.
Yes, yeah, I know.
And it was walking distance from wherever right. you must have been staying.
Right. And you walked in.
And I lived near the laundromat, or maybe right. in the laundromat. And I saw you, and I was like, I've seen him on television, and I just asked you about
yeah.
stand-up.
Yeah. I remember that.
I remember when I was living in New York and I was contemplating trying to figure out if I could do stand-up
yeah.
and get it. And I remember I was a nanny in New York, and Al Franken's kid was a...
You were a nanny?
I was a nanny in New York. And
did I know that? How do you... Don't you need a license for that or something?
No. I mean...
No. But how do you...
The family wanted a male nanny because she had two boys.
Yeah.
And they were older.
Yeah.
Kind of rambunctious, I think.
Like in their teens?
No, they were like 7 and I can't remember.
And how'd they find you?
I put up an ad at NYU, at the NYU,
uh-huh.
No, I didn't go there.
Right.
And they called me.
Right.
A wonderful, nice family. But I remember the school in which I would pick the kid up, Al Franken would pick his son up there, or child,
yeah.
I don't know. And I walked up to him and I asked for his advice. And he said, well, to be honest with you, you're probably not funny.
Yeah. To be honest with him.
Well, he was
talking
to
his nose.
And at the time, I was, what did that mean? But he was saying, look, a lot of people think they're funny.
Right.
And they're not. And yeah. you should know that.
Yeah.
And turns out he was right.
But you made a great living.
But it doesn't
out of
matter,
it.
Right?
Yeah. yeah. You made a great career out of it. But that thing about, like, I always appreciate the fact that you don't seem to, like we were talking about at the beginning, you don't feel compelled to do stand up. Right now?
No, I do feel compelled to do stand-up.
And you fight it?
Or what do
you do it? Well, I mean,
I
you
do
don't
it.
Tour.
I mean, I did it two. I just did it two nights ago. But, I mean, I do it as much. But to me, if you don't do it often,
yeah.
your rhythm is off.
Oh, yeah, I know.
And I haven't done it often enough of late to get my rhythm back. So it's just one of those things that you have to practice. I feel like you have
yeah,
to do
oh,
it
yeah,
constantly.
Right. And where'd you do it at?
Largo.
Yeah, with on someone's show? Or you did a whole night?
I did it with Regina Spector, John Mulaney, and Judd.
Regina Spector, the...
Apatow.
Oh, Regina Spector, the singer?
Singer.
And, oh, singer. So it was one of Apatow's things?
Yeah. And then there was a Q&A after with mm-hmm. me and Judd for some
yeah.
reason. And so there was a few questions. And the last question, this woman raises
yeah.
raises her hand and she goes, yes, can Regina Spector come out and sing another song?
Did he let her?
I got so livid at it.
You did not.
I fake livid.
Yeah, yeah,
know,
yeah.
The fake livid.
We are talking.
I was so offended. I was so happy she asked that. Because
did she come out and sing one?
Oh, she sang one, yeah.
Oh, that's good.
One. Oh, yeah.
Are we working in the same building? Have you been, this new show, what is it, Baskets?
Yeah, it's called Baskets.
And we heard at the beginning when we were putting the writer's room together, like, you know, Baskets is here, Zach's a
And Dave
show.
Anthony writes on your show?
Yeah, he does. And he performs on it. He's taking it over like a cancer.
Oh, it like a, like a cancer.
Yeah. We have a good chemistry together.
Yeah, I like you know? Dave a lot.
Yeah, he always speaks highly of you.
He does?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, he mentioned to me that you lost some weight. You look good.
He mentioned it to you? No, what is your assessment of it? Are you just saying?
No, you look good. Yeah, like he said, like, it makes me uncomfortable. But I'm not throwing him under the bus. But he's having a hard time adjusting to you looking healthy, apparently.
Well, if it makes him feel better, it's the reason I'm thin is because I'm dying.
Oh, well, that I'll tell him that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you want to go into that at all?
No, it's not that important.
What did you do? What did you stop doing things?
You know, I mean, I stopped drinking. That helps.
You did?
Oh, yeah. I don't drink.
At all?
Mm-mm.
Wow.
Yeah.
When did that happen?
Well, I had one of those nights that I've been looking for a while, and I woke up and I was like, okay, that should be probably the end of my drinking life.
How long ago was that?
4 years ago in March or it's hard for me to and then I drank at my wedding and I drank at one other wedding, Bobby Tisdale, who you
yeah.
know, and that was and I gave myself those breaks and I just you know, it's hard to I was a good drinker, but when you get older your focus goes
it's exhausting
on, you know, it's too much it's,
really?
And it's and I also think God I mean as I hate to I think we're kind of trained through Madison Avenue and all that. Like, that's the way to be a man and all that horseshit.
Through Madison Avenue?
Well,
did we just time travel?
You mean? No, I mean, you know,
I like it.
The advertisers out there.
I think that there was something put in place. Like, if you watch Mad Men, it's all about that. Those guys were drinking all the time.
Yeah.
It was set in motion then.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, Mad Men's not a, it's not a documentary.
No, it is a documentary. Well, am I watching it wrong?
It's a nice looking documentary.
It is. And I was surprised how much access they had.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, how did they get all that access? How did they do that?
It's fascinating.
And there were color cameras back then.
It was all amazing. Strange. It was all amazing. And a real dedication, the director and crew, to stay with that group of people.
Have people come here to ask you about the president? Are you bored with people asking you how that?
No, there's this cup. People like the cup. I put the cup under glass.
You got to.
I just shut the door. I hear this weird machine noise. I haven't been able to.
Oh, that's my car. I left it on because my son's inside it.
Like, some people have said, like, when are you going to stop talking about that? Never. President came to my house.
Well, I
there's
just
no reason.
Like, about
going
the lockdown.
It's like going to space.
Did
what?
Secret Service come here first?
Yeah, yeah.
Did all that?
Mm-hmm.
And did they come with a big motorcade?
Mm-hmm.
Whoa.
Well, that's the way he travels. It's not like he's going to, you know, hop
in a Vespa?
No.
Was there anything afterwards where you wish you had asked him?
Yeah, one question.
What was it?
Like, moving from like a senator to that, all of a sudden you are making decisions almost unilaterally that are both options are going to end in the loss of human life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what was the first one of those?
Mm.
And you know, how do you process that? Can you answer that question?
Yeah, you want me to answer instead?
Yeah.
Did you get to? I haven't heard the interview yet, but did you get a chance to ask him anything about Wall Street?
No, not specifically. Why you have worried about your money?
Because he did a Between Two Ferns thing with me, and that when we were done, I was like, I wish.
Well, that was a weird thing because that was for the healthcare plan.
That was like for the healthcare thing.
That was the quid pro quo that you had to deal
either
with.
Way, that's exactly right if we're going to use Latin terms. Uh-huh. But yeah, I mean, he had a thing, but I believe in the thing, so
yeah.
Why not?
And I like him, and I think that, well, there's always going to be, and there wasn't much from more so me because I did have some experience doing politics, that there might have been an expectation to sort of, you know, put his... to grill them a little bit. But the thing that people don't realize about politicians is that you can ask them whatever you want. I mean, they didn't give us a list of questions or vet us at all.
Mm.
Because you know why? Because the president can handle himself.
Right. That's right.
So, like, you can ask him, like, how does it feel to kill all those civilians? And he'll be like, well, you know, there's a tough decision in these. And then all of a sudden you're into this thing where, like, 3 minutes in, you're like, I don't even know what he's talking about. So, like, he's going to, you know, he's going to take it where he's going to. So I tried to just stay engaged.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it went pretty well. What was your experience with him?
I tell you, I.
Were you in awe? I mean, because you had to do a character.
I was nervous. I mean, because we did it in the White House. And he came to your house. I went to his. But I was nervous. But after the fact and after we did it and the video was released, I get a phone call from
mm-hmm.
him
mm-hmm.
and we're chatting and we chatted for a couple minutes. And then the last thing he said was, okay, I'll talk to you later, brother. And I hung up and I didn't know what to do. I was by myself at a construction site.
Yeah.
And I just stood up and took a picture of the chair I was standing in. As there's, you have a cup sitting on your desk for the president. I have a picture of an old chair. It was just amazing.
What did he want to talk about?
He was thanking
you.
No, he wanted to talk about some of my bits. No, he wanted to talk. He just wanted to thank. It was nice.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But let me ask you this, though. Because I had to, like, my struggle was to be myself. Like, you had to hold, you know, whatever the tone of that show was.
I have to be rude to
the president.
The president in the White House. But, I mean, I'm a respectful person, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a question that I'm sure was not, because his speechwriter, before we went in, I said to his speechwriter, Cody, who's so very funny, this guy.
Yeah.
And I pointed to a question. I said, has the president seen this question? And it was, what's it like to be the last black president? And Cody goes, no, I think so. Like, absolutely, he did not see it.
Right.
So when I knew I had to ask that question, there was a big, you know, lump in my heart. But he's a funny, I mean, he has a good sense of humor, President Obama.
Right. Yeah.
And that's rare in that town. Like, Washington, D.C. is not a funny town to me. Is that Iggy Pop?
Yeah. He was in here.
Unbelievable.
What do you mean? You know,
well, I didn't know he was.
Do you listen to anything?
Pop.
I'm not asking you to listen to my podcast, but I've been doing it a while.
You know, Mark, I got to tell you, I don't know if you remember this, but years ago, I told you should be on 60 Minutes as the Andy Rooney at the end.
Right. The cranky guy.
You should. Yeah. I mean, that's where this job that you're doing
I'm
envious.
Should? What? I don't need 60 Minutes anymore.
No, you don't need it.
Radio. I don't need anything.
You don't need the man anymore. No.
I don't need the man.
Mm-mm,
it's a very weird feeling. No one does if you plan it right.
Yeah.
But there's still some people that are sort of like, nah, I kind of like the man.
Yeah. Well, certain avenues you need the man, I
right,
guess.
Right, right. Well, the man sort of like, you know, it's literally a lot of the reason why some people need the man is the same is a parental thing. It's like, well, you know, he got me this chair. And
yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He made me this nice room and I can sit in here. So, all right. So let's talk about, but before we talk about Baskets, which, how many episodes of that did you do?
10.
Really? Do you like them?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a very, specific odd show,
yeah,
with kind of weird dramatic undertones but very dumb humor,
yeah,
and the tone of that is kind of new, and I hope audiences find it okay.
Now Louis produced it?
Yeah, well, Louis called me and asked, Louis C.K. called me and asked me if I would have any interest in trying to write a TV show.
Because he had the deal at Fox, or at FX.
Yeah.
So they were like, make some shows.
I guess.
And he called you.
I guess, yeah. Yeah. And I you know, my confidence level has never really been strong for anything. And I thought about it, and then he and I started chatting, and he made it really easy and gave me a lot of room and freedom. And you know, we came up with this show about a bitter rodeo clown.
That was something that you sat there with Louis or on the phone and you were like, here's some of the ideas that I'm having.
Well, first it was going to be a behind the scenes of Between Two Ferns. That was my idea. I was going to kind of make it that.
Right.
And I couldn't make sense of that in my head. And then Louis and I started chatting. And I remember sitting around. I like to sit and act like I'm thinking.
Right.
And Rodeo Clown popped in my head. And something about him being trained in Paris made Louis and I laugh, like a
trained clown, a real clown,
like, you know, more artistic.
Sure. And he ended up there somehow.
So he goes there to study clown theory, and he's terrible. And
yeah,
he drops out and goes and moves back to his hometown in Bakersfield, and all the only work he can get is a rodeo clown. So he has a chip on his shoulder.
Yeah.
So that's the basis of.
So it takes place in Bakersfield.
Yeah, Bakersfield and Paris.
Paris too.
Yeah.
Did you shoot in Paris?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
And those are flashbacks, or
those are flashbacks? Yes, yeah, yeah. It was so fun to go to Paris. I mean, obviously, I've never really been behind the scenes of a TV show. Well, no, I had a talk show years ago, but I wasn't paying attention.
At VH1,
yeah,
with the hat.
Yes, Mark, with the hat.
I'm not condescending. I was the guy that had the game show on the flip side of your fucking hat show.
Oh yeah,
and we both tanked together. I'm in no way.
That's right. I forgot.
I'm not taking the upper hand here.
That's yes.
We both went down together with what's his name.
Well, VH1. I mean, it was not the greatest place to do.
The weird thing was though is like they, you know, in terms of changing the tone, they were just like about a decade too soon.
Mm.
That, you know, what they saw in you or the idea of was like to make it more specific to what they pictured, you know, primarily I think white youth. As being at that time.
But they came to me and told me people I could not make fun of.
Right.
Artists of theirs that I couldn't make fun of.
Right. Well, I think they were trying to reach out to a segment of audience that didn't quite exist yet.
What, the Cher fans?
Tony Braxton fans. I just remember, like, there was this horrible moment in show business where I think we were both there. Maybe I'm wrong. Where they were doing the sort of the big kind of like launch thing, in-house launch thing. And they wanted me to do like an episode of the Buzzcocks live with a couple of people. I don't know if you were there or not.
Mm-mm.
Maybe you weren't, but I just remember that. What's his name? Fred.
Oh, Graver.
Graver, right. And he got up there to address VH1, which was pretty entrenched in what VH1 was. And he thought it'd be cute to wear that hat that you were wearing, you know, on all the bus stops and everything. So he gets up there with that dumb hat going like, and I just looked at a room full of people who had been doing it a certain way for over a decade, just like this, like,
yeah,
no,
this is
toughest fucking room. And I'm like, this is doomed.
Yeah.
I couldn't have been happier that didn't work out for me.
Yeah.
I had no idea what the game show was. I hosted it for 13 episodes. I have no idea.
I remember when that show got canceled for me, I just went right back to open mics.
Yeah.
I just right back to open mics. I'm like, okay, it's a do-over.
But then you've gone on to amazing success. So now, okay, Baskets is excited. It sounds good. I'm excited about it now. The billboards are hard to understand. But
Well, you've never liked my billboards.
I haven't.
What you were alluding to with the hat thing, because
that was like Marky Mark's ass in New York. I mean, it was like fucking everywhere.
That's the thing with this business is like everything has to be out of the gate big. It's like just let people find a show.
Yeah.
Well, you know what I mean?
The one thing you get with FX2 and because you're working with Louis, and what I get with IFC is that you do have freedom to do it.
There's
nothing better than that.
Yeah. I didn't know that even existed. I assumed it never existed. But when Louis told me, hey, they won't bug you, he was completely to his word. They have been nothing but cool. And the notes they have given me, and I not to blow smoke up, but have been really, really, I agreed with all the notes, which is rare.
Well, I think that happened to me too on Marin. And it's like, it's a gift. It's a great thing. And I think one of the reasons is because they in some ways have, you know, less to lose. It's a much more competitive market. There's no system in place anymore. They can't pretend to know the answers. They just can't. So, you know, they trust in the creatives.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And that's the smart way to be. They're the business people. We're the jokesters.
When's it on? Do you know? Is there a date?
It's the 21st of January.
Oh, really?
And so I don't know what time it's
that's
on.
That's soon. The 21st.
Yeah.
I'll get the information.
Do you know Louis Anderson? He's in it.
Really?
Yeah.
For a lot of them?
I think he's in all of them.
Really?
He plays my mom.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. I don't know if I'm supposed to say that. I can't remember if we're trying to keep it a secret or not. I wanted to cast Brenda Blethyn, is that her name, the English actress?
And I'm not sure.
She's one of my favorite actresses, but I never know how to pronounce her name.
Yeah.
And she was not available.
Uh-huh.
And Louis C.K. and I were talking about it, and I was like, I don't know, Louis. There's a voice in my head. And we looked at, you know, a lot of people, actresses, reels, and
yeah.
It's like, there's a voice. And he goes, what kind of voice? And I'm like, kind of like Louis Anderson's voice. And he goes, should we call Louis? And I went, yeah. And a minute later, Louis are talking the phone.
Yeah.
And I remember the conversation. Hey, Louis, it's Louis. Uh-huh. Hey, I'm doing the show with Zach Galifianakis. Uh-huh. Here's the we want you to be in it. Okay. Here's the thing. We want you to play his mom. I'll do it. Exactly how it went down. And it has been a really, really, I mean, he steals the show.
Does he?
Yeah. Yeah. And I kind of want to be the straight man in this show a little bit. So he is
That's so beautiful.
Funny to me.
It's beautiful. He's very funny.
He has like a lot of siblings, he was telling me. And,
yeah.
And I mean, like 9 or 10. And I said, Louis, where do you fall in line? Like,
yeah.
From a number of siblings. And he goes, almost successful.
No, he's a sweetheart
and
one of the great comics.
Yeah,
really.
He's really great.
But what about how many more hangovers are there?
We're contracted up to 12. So, and I feel a real appetite out there for more. I feel people really want.
Everyone always asked me when I told people I was talking to you. I'm like, ask them when it's coming. Where do they go now, those guys?
Yeah, it's look. That was
a good
chunk
time.
Of my life that I do not regret at all. But
it's a good time.
It was. I wish we had just done one.
Really?
I think leave well enough alone sometimes. You know.
How many did you do? Three.
Three. And yeah. Now we have to do 9 more.
Are you doing any more?
No.
Okay.
No.
All right.
No, I mean. In 10 years when this all dries up, I'm sure I'll be knocking on people's doors like, hey, I got this idea.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I'm still weird. And now, I think one of the reasons you seem better outside of perhaps not drinking and growing up is you have a child.
Yes.
How old's the child?
I don't know.
Yeah.
He's two.
He's a he?
It's a he.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, these days.
You might check in occasionally. That must be great for you. You seem like a good father.
I got to tell you, going back to what we were talking about, Madison Avenue and all the beer commercials, right. Like fatherhood is, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, I just love it. I have no complaints. It's changed the chemistry in my body I'm a morning person now.
Yeah.
I go out and walk and say good morning to morning people are the nicest people in the world. Yeah, if you want to meet nice people in Los Angeles, go out at 6 a.m. I don't want to bore your audience, but I just being a dad has been the highlight of my life.
Do you have an exit strategy?
For what?
For life? Like, are you gonna like at some point go like, I'm taking the family?
There's a dropout scenario that's definitely going to happen where you just kind of.
But you can do that if you want. I mean, theoretically, like, and I'm just saying because I think about this. Like, obviously, you're at a different pay grade than me, but there is a.
Also, you got my text.
Yeah, there is three of them. Like, just remember,
right.
Who's in charge. But I mean, you could like this is. I'm just fighting with this myself. It's like, why don't people go like, I'm done. I'm going to take my kid and my wife and go live a deep quality life away from this shit.
But I think that somebody like you and I have a selfish pull to entertain people. There's like a need. So I don't think I can ever stop doing. I don't want to stop doing stand up ever.
Right. Right.
Because I feel like that's the one thing I would really miss.
Mm-hmm.
But all the other stuff. I mean, look. As we were saying early, there's your life and there's your work life.
And you're able to separate it.
Your life is more important.
Right. Do you still have a farm?
I still own that, but we moved our farm to another
farm?
Yes. So we moved out of North Carolina.
Don't tell me where you went. But you've got another place?
Yeah.
And it's a nice place?
There's nothing. I mean, it's just a farming community,
really,
and an artist community. It's
really
like the two things I love. I like artists and I like farmers.
Uh-huh.
And we found this place where it has both.
Uh-huh.
And it's magnificent.
And so you got some property. You got an existing farm, or you built one?
We bought a cabin from a woman who I think was a witch.
Oh, great!
A good witch.
Yeah,
and it's a pretty hippy dippy place. So it's
you like hippies, huh?
I like hippies. I just like
free living,
grounded. No, I like grounded, earthy type people.
Right, right.
I think the tree huggers in the end, and I don't mean the dope smoking hippie, that kind of irresponsible. I mean the tree huggers. They're always right in the end.
Yeah,
they all. I mean, the tree huggers have been worrying about climate change.
Mm-hmm.
I remember as a kid since the '70s.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and they everybody
knew.
Rolled their eyes.
Yep.
And just dismissed them. And
right now, it's too late.
Now it's too late.
Now we're fucked.
Yeah.
There's no turning it back.
Yeah.
It's always great to see you.
If you will you
what?
Let's would you come?
Yeah.
Let's go to dinner and stuff. You know, you and I went to dinner with a old girlfriend of yours in Albuquerque.
That at El Pinto.
Exactly.
The fuck is that noise? Can you hear it? It's like
it might be my pacemaker.
Oh no, are you? Oh no.
Yeah.
I
hear that noise. What is that?
Let's go find out. It was very nice to talk to Zach. That was the best we ever got along, and we always kind of get along, but for some reason, I used to just kind of bust his balls a little bit and mildly bully him, but it was not there this time. And he looks great. He lost some weight. So, folks, I don't know if you know Centra Wilson, but she's written a lot of great stuff, and she's an incredible wit and quite a brilliant person. I was very excited to talk to her. As I said before, you can get her new book, Fear and Clothing, Unbuckling American Style, now. And you can listen to me talk to the brilliant Centra Wilson right now. The last time I saw you was probably 2007, and you were like... you had an energy. It was very specific. It felt like you were on the run. Like there was clandestine forces against you, and You've been in D.C. too long. You're like,
are you sure I'm just not like socially anxious in ways?
Well, tell me. I mean, at that time, you were entrenched in politics.
I was. Yeah, that'll bum anybody out for a long time.
Right, but you were literally like, I got to be cool. You know, there was some part of you that was like,
I'm not supposed to talk about that.
Yeah, I know too much.
I was being warned that I did at certain points.
Really?
But, I mean, it'll make me sound crazy if I discuss it, but yeah, I was like...
Then let's discuss it.
I don't know, I was like dating a senior Pentagon official of my friends, and I had been in the White House press corps, and so I knew my phone was tapped because they actually tell you we're going to tap your phone for the rest of your life, and you can hear them clicking in and clicking off and stuff. So I wasn't actually paranoid, but it could come off that way. If I was talking to me, I'd think I was paranoid.
Well, yeah, for someone who's on the outside of that, I was like, man, you got to get out. I felt like I was like a sort of pivotal part in a movie. That was like,
you needed to do a Potomac intervention on me.
Get you out of there in hiding into some sort of witness protection program or out of the country.
I don't hang out there anymore.
You're out?
Yeah, I'm out of politics and D.C.
Me too.
I really just... You know, you learn the thing and you go and you take the blue pill and you see the truth and it's hateful and horrible. And
the truth is, like, what truth did you find? I found that no matter what you do or how above it all or critical you may be, you're going to be carrying water for somebody.
Absolutely. And that you cannot talk about politics in a way that will actually engage people that you wish would be engaged.
Like
I tried to make really obscure information palatable and funny. And basically the only person who read Caligula for President, my last book, was you.
Yeah.
And, you know, I basically wrote it for you or it doesn't exist. So.
Thank you for doing that. That's a lot of forethought on your part, because it wasn't like we were talking, but you knew somewhere that I had to get it to Marin.
It's actually dedicated to Batman because the senior Pentagon official I was dating didn't want me to dedicate it to him by name.
Really?
Yeah, I was in a bad place.
That was my feeling. You were in a bad place.
Well, I mean, I didn't think I was. I was really, and you know, I'm very, very insatiably curious.
What was it that made you sort of hit the wall with that? Because like when I did political talk, when I did the radio stuff, you know, we were fielding stuff from the left, from the far left, you know, and from, trying to get the facts as well. And, you know, also keeping abreast of whatever the right was dishing out. But like it really gets to a point where you realize that it's not a game, it's a business.
That's right.
And that there is no real representation, that the idea of democracy is kind of like, it's just placating people who are okay and completely brainwashing people who are angry.
The brainwashing part is the part that really bummed me out. Yeah. I mean, and also when you realize that these organisms are just so immense. I mean, a place like the Department of Defense, there's, you know, 4 million employees with security clearances in the country. I mean, there's no way to keep track of any of that. Like, the defense industry doesn't have any idea how much the defense industry is spending.
Right.
I mean, you know, they just watch the wheel spin at a certain point and the money go by. I mean, there's no checks and balances on anything anymore. I mean, the dragon has no head, is a friend of mine was fond of saying. So.
Wow. Yeah, I guess so. And did you eventually get disillusioned and fall into a deep darkness?
Yes. Oh, yeah. No, you have to, I think. But I feel like you have to do your time with it. Wasn't it Kafka who said, you know, well, if you're an artist, you have a certain moral obligation to talk about these horrible political things that nobody wants to talk about? And I thought, well, yeah, Kafka.
Yeah,
sure. I should really do that. Nobody loved me for it. Nobody cared. Nobody read it.
Well, Kafka was dealing in sort of, you know, long and dense metaphors.
Like, well, he had to or he'd get killed. But
right,
you know,
maybe
you
should have approached it that way, with the fear for your life.
Yeah, I'm going to start by talking about the DOD as like an insect hive or something like that.
So you lived there? You were in D.C. You were living in D.C. for a while?
I was in and out of there. I had a lot of friends there. My best friend from childhood had a major program in the Pentagon, which is the human terrain system. And I was what my friends called a counterterrorism groupie. Which is probably the worst kind of groupie.
What is the human terrain system, please?
It is no longer a part of what we do, but it was the reintroduction of anthropology into defense, because anthropology was just not something... Like, when we first went into Iraq and Afghanistan after 9/11, we made a lot of really, really stupid mistakes as a country just by not knowing basic stuff, like the difference between, you know, Sunni
the
and
tribal
Shia
culture.
And not knowing anything about, you know, how to deal with
so
people.
They needed to create some sort of program to educate people about the people they were killing?
Correct.
Or trying to...
Correct. Yes.
Oh.
Know your enemy, I think, was their
Or at
slogan.
Least know what they like to wear and what team they're on. And
Or just
you know,
how not to
they're...
offend them, you know, by offering them a handshake full of what they think is shit or something. You know, it's like, I'm sorry, should I not swear?
No, you can swear.
I can swear. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So that oh, so that's interesting. So this is a person you knew from childhood who went to as an anthropologist?
Yeah, I wish we had the same impoverished upbringing on the Sausalito houseboats. And
she's in this book.
Yeah, she is. She's
at the beginning
of
the book. Oh, she is?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, she's just been a major influence on my life because she's absolutely brilliant, the most brilliant person I've ever known. She went from, you know, by her own bootstraps, ended up getting a full ride to Yale and then went to Harvard and then went to D.C. And
do you have a chip on your shoulder about Ivy League people?
I used to.
Because you're pretty smart.
I wrote this book and then I was like, fuck it. I have a PhD. I'm giving it to myself. I don't care anymore about anybody's education. I can go toe-to-toe with most people about my chosen subjects.
Well, okay, let's talk about that, because I'm trying to think about the first time I saw you, like when I fell in love with you, was probably when you were on the cover of Mondo.
That was so long ago.
No, I know, but I don't know. I probably brought this up before. What was that time? So was it 91, 92?
Yeah, I was doing plays in San Francisco. Yeah.
You're this local sort of child genius playwright, like a cultural icon.
Did a lot of bad plays, a lot of nude photographs. Yeah.
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 And I think I met you once at a party. Your parents were 60s lunatics, right?
Totally. Yeah. No, they're beatniks. Mostly like
beatniks, like that generation.
Educated. You know, it's like they sort of looked down on other hippies because they didn't do as many drugs. But my mother is still a jazz musician in San Francisco who calls herself the Duchess. And I knew you'd like that. And my father taught art at one of the world's worst universities for 37 years,
Which
Chico
one?
State, where I was born. I was born in Chico, California.
Really? I don't even know where Chico State is. I know where Davis is.
It's sort of, yeah, Chico's like in the middle of the Sacramento River Valley where all the orchards are.
Sacramento's the worst.
Oh, it's grim over there. It was actually in 1986, it's in the book, it was voted the number one party campus
right.
in America because people kept dying in the swimming pools.
Because they were too drunk to swim?
They were too drunk. And then like there was these people called the Beer Pirates. I talk about it a little bit in the book where they had like taken a Coors belt buckle with the Coors logo on it and made a branding iron out of it, and they would like actually sear the Coors logo into the skin of passed out freshmen.
Oh my
so
god.
So they had to cancel Frontier Week. Just tradition.
And that's
around
what your
that
dad
school.
Taught. What did he teach? Art history?
Art. He was art, you know, full professor. He taught, you know, art.
So you grew up like
art.
You grew up like in a educated, open-minded, exploratory.
They both have terminal degrees. They're very, uh-huh. very intelligent, crazy people.
Well, how the fuck did they end up on a houseboat in Sausalito?
It was cheap. I mean, they were trying to get me into a better school district, and they're like,
"Where the ocean?
This is $9,000, and everybody's stoned." So it's like, it was, it was an interesting community. I mean, it was very radical, and actually, it was a community that was pretty much like we would talk about it as being off the grid now because they were openly flouting all of these laws in Sausalito.
Yeah.
And they kept like where Mitzi grew up, my friend, it was actually just like about a quarter of a mile down the street. There were riots during our childhood because they were trying to gentrify her dock, which was, you know, all this crazy shit, like, you know, just like trailers sitting on like orange pontoons. And then, like, everybody's toilet was basically just like a shelf that emptied out into the bay. And, you know, and it was. And Sausalito didn't like that. Everybody was getting their power from the streetlight in the parking lot, and they would just run a million extension cords to like 17 different homes. And it was.
That's crazy.
It was crazy. It was a crazy time.
But you, how old were you?
Under 10, probably.
But you have very specific memories.
Oh, yeah. No, it was very formative.
Those are weird memories that you have because they're usually sort of like either terrifying or sexual, like the memories that hit you.
You know, it's especially in the 70s and especially
right.
in that area.
I can't imagine it.
It was crazy. Like when I would catch the school bus every day, there would be these women that we called the hitch hookers who would be standing right next to me in like rabbit fur jackets who would like be hitchhiking with their thumbs out. And they totally looked all, you know, walk of shame, clapped out at 7 o'clock in the morning, and like I'd be there with, you know, going to fourth grade, you know, waiting for the school bus, and if the hitchhikers weren't there, and I was waiting for a bus, like coit drapery vans would pull up and honk and like wait for me to get in, and I'm like, no,
no, I'm a child,
no, keep going. God, there was famous children's authors who lived in the houseboats, and you knew like not to go near certain people because they had, you know, short eyes tendencies. But I mean, back then it was like, you knew that, you know, like people would warn you, like, you don't want to go over to that guy's houseboat. You know?
Really? Right. The houseboat.
We're not going to name names, but, you know.
But they were neighbors. You know?
And everybody knew, like, just don't let your 11-year-old girl near that guy.
Oh, you my know? God. But so what was your, because you're really sharp and you write for the New York Times.
I did. They fired me.
Okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, you sort of came about it and like really creating, it was your own path. I mean, you didn't, you know, like, you see, like, because in the book, and even just the part I read, which seems to be a pretty important part because it really deals with your formative years of what drove you to sort of assessing culture and being consumed by it, and then somewhat defining some of it on your own.
Right.
There's I like the little part where you you wore a swimming cap to
I felt like that was one of my great fashion triumphs of all time.
It made so much sense. It was so hilarious. What this was like. So where do we go? You go from fourth grade, and then what happens in San Francisco? You move off the boat?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I moved off the boat, and then I kind of just went into... I moved into the city very early when I was a teenager, and I mean, I don't know how far you got into the book. It talks about where...
You weren't a runaway, though. You were just getting... You know, your parents let you.
I was a runaway, but I kept... Yeah, I mean, they kept kind of making me come back. I mean...
You're a runaway, but a car ride away.
I was a truant.
They knew where you were.
I was in juvenile hall and stuff. I was a problem child.
Well, how'd you end up in juvie?
Oh, all kinds of reasons. Drugs.
Drugs?
But mostly just like being completely rampant and uncontrollable.
That's what led to your genius.
That's what they say now. At the time, I was just a bad child.
But when you finally got into the crystal meth period, that was...
I'm glad you read that part. I didn't want to have to bring it up myself.
No. That was a great part. I love the description of hobbies and fashion choices and making your own outfit.
Oh, my God. You're going to bring up the fish, aren't you?
You had goldfish earrings?
Oh, yeah. That is the lowest fashion point of my life.
Was that also the lowest drug point of your life?
Absolutely. Absolutely the lowest. I've never been that high ever since. Not once.
Well, the weird thing about, because I lived in San Francisco only for like a couple years, but I always felt off center there. I could never figure out what was, it always felt so ungrounded to me. Like I couldn't get
unmoored.
I could not get a handle on it.
You can't get an anchor anywhere there. Yeah,
that's
true.
Right. Why
shifting
is that?
Shifting sands. Well, I mean, especially when you were there. I mean, when we were talking about
93.
Yeah, those times. I mean, it's like, this is when we were still describing the Haight-Ashbury is where, you know, 20-year-olds get a BA and then go to retire.
Right.
You know, to a life of broken motorcycles and black t-shirts. I mean, it's sort of like, I did it, you know. For a while, it was fun. You thought you were going to live forever, and you got really stupid tattoos, and you know,
And you could afford to live there, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, you could afford to live in what was then a rotting old Victorian, and you could buy a lot of rotting old Victorian clothing to go with it, and you know, at the thrift store, and it was fun.
But yeah, but like even now, like I know that everything's changed. I was living on, I guess I lived on South Van Ness in like 23rd.
I lived there too.
Really?
I lived on 23rd and South Van Ness in several different apartments. I lived in 24th and South Van Ness, 22nd and South Van Ness, and 23rd and South Van Ness twice.
I think I knew, like you described some woman. There was a woman that I saw one morning when I woke up walking down the street that is like indelible in my memory. She was walking down the street wearing like a tutu and combat boots with a shaved head. Was that you?
I probably knew that girl. No, that sounds like my friend Lisa.
Like, and I was like, oh my God.
That was a look. Yeah, my friend Lisa. That probably was Lisa.
I bet you it was.
Yeah, I bet it was.
Because there's like so many locals there. They're still around. You go up there, you probably see a lot of the people that you grew up with.
It wasn't like
there was
a lot of girls in tutus and combat boots. I mean, it wasn't a day look for a lot of
right,
people.
Right. No, it was. I couldn't stop. I was just like stopped in my tracks. Like, what the fuck is happening in the world? It's amazing.
Oh, man. Yeah, I felt partially responsible for her decline. I can maybe directly attribute that fashion crime crime partially to myself.
Hey, were you guys in some sort of fashion battle?
I introduced her to the wrong people.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I did.
Your friends?
Yeah, I did.
Something about that, about San Francisco and that weird feeling, like, I think you described it really well, and I didn't know some of that history about why it became sort of the gay capital and gay-friendly port that it is.
I thought that was really fascinating.
How come I never knew that?
Well, I looked it up because it was just the hunch that I had that the local economy, because when I talk about in the book how growing up in San Francisco, I was very influenced by drag queens and speed freaks, because they were fabulous fashion animals, and these were the people who taught me about glamour and style and personal style. And then I was thinking about that as an economy, because there is a huge gay economy, and then I was like, well, why is there a huge gay economy in San Francisco? And then I looked it up, and it's like, and they're during the 40s, when they decided that homosexuals could not be in the Army or Navy, they outprocessed 40,000 service persons out into San Francisco and just left them there.
And they were like, this is nice.
They stayed. Yeah. They're like, great, thanks. You know, then.
Because I always sort of track the history in my mind without being very informed that it was always kind of a capital of weirdness and American sort of individuality with the prospectors, which you brought up. And then I guess the gay population, but how that led into, you know, the Beats and the hippies and like how it all happened and why there, it's sort of, I can't quite define it. I don't know why.
I mean, there's different theories about that. I mean, you know, the hippie theory is that there was so much yerba buena, you know, like herb, like wafting off of the mountainsides that everybody was like sort of high all the time. And it just created this sort of euphoric sense of community. Who knows?
That all came tumbling down because of speed.
It really did. I mean, we thought speed was a uniter back then.
No, it destroyed the love.
And the teeth.
Yeah. So where did you end up? You grew up a little bit. You didn't end up in jail for long periods of time.
I was detained. I mean, no, I went to juvie, and then I was in an institution or two.
Yeah,
not for long. A couple of months, you know, because I was crazy.
From the speed.
Just from the crazy. I mean, like, when I was a kid, they really didn't know that girls could be hyperactive and have ADHD.
Yeah.
And so I was like this freak show. I mean, they didn't understand what they were looking at. And they just thought, you know, I was, you know, evil.
So, possessed.
Pretty much.
So you ended up in a couple of hospitals?
Yeah, for short periods of time when I was, like, a teenager.
Yeah.
Like, and then my parents sent me to Poland, which was a really strange choice.
Why?
I think they wanted me to get shot. It was under martial law, and I really cannot fathom what the thinking process was.
Well, what they presented as?
Well, they said that, you know, there was this Polish guy who was living in my bedroom, and he couldn't go back home because he had been running underground newspapers, and, you know, the Polish equivalent of the Stasi was going to, you know, put him away if he ever went back. So they sent me to live with his family.
Yeah, an exchange program with an outlaw.
To, like, you know, enjoy the riots of Warsaw.
How long were you there?
Another couple months. And then
how'd that go?
It was very curious. Well, they gave me a one-way ticket, and they said, you know, there's a film school in Wut. Why don't you learn Polish and go to this film school? And I was like, what? You know,
so they dispatched their parental duties. They're like, we've done all we could.
I'm just not even gonna. I'm just gonna nod, and you and I will wink at each other, and I won't say anything.
They did
to confirm or deny.
Yeah. So they sent you off, and you didn't go to film school. Did you get in trouble in Poland?
I couldn't learn Polish in 2 months. In fact, Woot is like in the middle of Poland. It's like rural Poland, you know. And it's like, what, I'm supposed to go like knock on Andre Vida's door and go, "Hi, I'm an American drug addict. Hello."
So did you come home and, well, you must have been pretty, was there any social excitement there? Did you?
I had a very nice time there, actually. I mean, the Polish guy's sister and his family turned out to be a really lovely family, and they were really, really nice to me, and I had a very, very good time, and traveled on a little boat around all the weirdest, weirdest places in Poland, you know, Węgorzewa and Mikołajki and Gdańsku, where you, like, you know, park your little boat, and then you, like, walk 2 miles through cow shit into some, like, sort of, like, amazing little throbbing proto-disco that looks like it was made by, like, disco cavemen, you know. It was just, Really amazing.
So it was good for you. It was a healthy trip.
Actually, it really was. It was really good for me. Yeah, and the beer is only like 8% alcohol there. So you basically, you know, you had to drink your entire body weight to get even a remote buzz on. So it was pretty much impossible to get fucked up.
And that was all that was available to you?
That was it. That was it. Yeah.
So your parents did the best thing they could.
Perhaps. I don't want to call this a good decision. I hate them too much for it, but it might have been productive.
You still hate them?
Do I still hate them? Hate is not, you know, we're enlightened and we're in our 40s now. We don't say things like hate.
I'm in my 50s and I still process this shit.
I have to process this shit all the
time. Like every fucking every time I think about them and their self-centeredness and their ridiculous self-involvement.
The me generation sucked as parents. Can we just say that categorically?
It's like no one calls it what it is. It's fucking emotional neglect.
Yeah.
Yeah, just you know, your kids aren't your friends, they're your kids.
Yeah.
And you can't just be like sort of like, oh, this one's, I don't want to hang out with them anymore.
I've had it with you. But they did that all the time. I mean, it's like half of the kids that I know were out of the house at 15, 16.
Right.
Couch surfing. I mean, I grew up with this incredibly high-risk generation. Very weird scene because grew up in Marin County, which is supposed to be the wealthiest, one of the wealthiest suburbs in the world.
Right.
And we had one of the highest suicide rates on earth. It was like Finland or Japan, you know. It's like just mass. Like something like 15% of my high school in the 4 years I was there killed itself. Yeah. Really amazing. Like not just at high school, but in the probably 15 years that followed, there was just a staggering amount of suicide.
That's interesting. And it was all that, well, that generation of those type of people who lived in that area, most of them probably came to that area for specific selfish reasons.
Yeah, the hot tubs and the wife swapping and the cocaine.
And that's it. And they just like left their kids like without a sense of identity. Or structure.
There's these goddamn orthodontists and their sense of entitlement, you know? What did they do to us, Mark?
Well, I don't think I experience as much hate as I try to, have some empathy, but it's hard.
Well, you know, my mother's big fallback excuse is, it was a different time.
Oh, yeah,
you know?
That one, yeah.
And it's sort of like, yeah, okay. But I still can't have a relationship, and I blame you.
It's true, right?
It's true.
I'm emotionally crippled.
I'm emotionally traumatized completely. I have emotional PTSD. Yeah, it's triggered by all kinds of shit.
Incapable to receive or give love properly and completely distrusting of emotions.
That's you and I should, like, go to the same old folks home and we can play backgammon for tranquilizers. It'll be good.
But since I haven't met anybody with specifically similar problems like that, but it's a really weird thing to, you know, you can forgive, I guess, to a certain point, but then you still have to deal with what is your emotional life. I mean, we've obviously done okay for ourselves. We're creative people. We can think.
We've worked hard at it, too. I mean, I know you have.
Right.
You are shockingly, scouringly investigational of yourself. I mean, in the shows of yours that I've seen, I'm always like, you know, it's like staring into the sun of somebody.
But how do you get over that shit that you didn't, like, there's this whole, you know, that the idea of like, well, I can parent myself now, or I can make cognitive decisions to do things differently. It doesn't mean you're going to be comfortable. You're ever going to get fucking comfortable. And the bad shit still feels better than the good shit.
It's exactly true. But this is like, but there's so many more layers of this, because I also think that we grew up, and I talk about this like further along in the book. Like, I believe that not only did we have me generation parents, but we also suffered from this sort of much larger form of social engineering, which I like to call sexual apartheid, where I think that we have been conditioned by all of the forces of the media since since Barbie and G.I. Joe, you know, who couldn't play on the same playground together because they were the wrong scale.
Yeah.
Remember, Barbie was too fucking tall. You couldn't, like, they couldn't interact. So you had the boys on one end of the playground, the girls over here. And then I think it has led to this. And then we have all of these mythologies, like the Disney princess. Everybody's supposed to get married. You know, you have, you know, the prom dress, and then that's a gateway dress to, you know, the wedding dress. Everything's about that goddamn wedding dress. And, you know, for women are still conditioned to think that you're going to get married and your life is going to be solved. And even on smart, hateful girls like me, on some terrible reptilian level, I was still seeking out that kind of strange thing until
fairy tale.
Yeah, because you don't even realize how deeply it is embedded in your DNA at this point. I mean, we really do believe these terrible myths. Like, women believe terrible myths about what men are and what they're supposed to be.
Yeah.
And men have terrible misunderstandings about us and what we're supposed to be. And then we each project all of these things onto each other all the time. And we can't ever just sort of deal with each other as is. I don't think we deal with each other straight because there's too much expectation.
Right. Until you get old and none of that shit matters anymore.
Yeah, and by then you're not fuckable.
Yeah. So it's like, let's just hang out. Let's just sit here and drink some coffee.
And talk about how much you hate everything.
Yeah, yeah. No, I guess that's true. But like, if I think about myself, I never played with G.I. Joes. I always felt so uncomfortable with just about everything.
I just
squirrely. But like, yeah, and then eventually you bust out and you seek identity through, you know, what you were talking about in the book, through how, you know, when you learn how easy it is to become sort of something just by putting on your outfit.
The ways that you can sort of pull a snow job over, you know,
but also you're
community.
But you're also seeking some definition of self. I mean, like, I don't think, like, when I decided to dress like Tom Waits when I was a sophomore in high school, with my little hat, just like Tom Waits on the cover of Nighthawks
so
at the Diner, that I was looking for an identity. I don't think I had any real idea that, like, you know, this was going to be powerful or anything. I just wanted to be associated with something that seems set.
But it's also about how, this is how you find yourself and or your wardrobe and your personal style. It's like, you know, you're not going to invent the goddamn wheel again. It's like, this is, you find yourself attracted to certain images.
Right.
And this is how you recognize a part of yourself. And then I think that, you know, you correctly incorporate these, and then you're like, okay, well, maybe the Brian Setzer, you know, rockabilly pompadour and the really, really pointy creepers aren't going to work for me into my 30s, you know?
Well, that's funny because a lot of those things only happen on album covers.
The rest of the time, Brian Setzer is wearing, like, Dockers.
Exactly.
And, you know, a polo shirt with a Microsoft logo on it.
I think that's probably true, that so many of the things that we were modeling our entire lives around were someone else's job.
It's really true. It's really true. And then I do think that, like, pervasive media imagery kind of told us that we were supposed to dress like the fantasy, because there is this fantasy that the fantasy, and I call it the fantasy, you know, capital E, capital F, I mean,
yeah,
just now, not in the book or anything.
Right.
But it's sort of this image of lifestyle that you see in, like, rap videos or in the ads for, like, in Vogue or W or high fashion magazines, where you see this impossible lifestyle where everybody looks amazing and perfectly plucked and trimmed. And
yeah.
Everybody's, you know, ass out in a bikini and wearing Jimmy Choo's and, you know, graciously accepting diamonds and looking half dead with teased hair. And it's amazing, you know, but nobody really lives that life. I mean, the great lie, I think, is socioeconomic. As you know, I mean, it's like 0.00001% of the world owning everything and selling the mythology that this lifestyle exists and is attainable by you.
Yeah.
And while this lifestyle has never been attainable for people like me, I mean, my family used to be middle class and now we're like a Walker Evans photo.
It's like, you've got the old truck filled with everything.
Oh my God.
Looking for a home.
The bath mats, you know, like on the clothesline with the ham radio antenna. It's grim. Yeah, it's grim.
I think, like, just by that percentage number, like, it's fair to say that really no one lives like that.
Well, I mean, what was that statistic? And I'm going to be really close if this isn't actually it, but 86 people in the world own 56% of everything that is ownable on planet Earth.
Yeah.
And when you think about, you know, incredibly rich families, it's like, what does somebody do with $33 billion a year that they may need to make more than that? I mean, it's like, I don't even think that if you can't abstractly quantify the spending of $33 billion, like, okay, I'm gonna cover Iowa 4 miles deep in pumpkins. You know, it's like, if you can't think of a way to spend it, you shouldn't be able to have it. I mean,
so, it's just power.
It's power, man. And it's at that point, it's like abstract wealth. And the only thing that they're doing is keeping it from you or
right.
other people. I mean,
right.
they're just hoarding
and
it.
And making sure that you can't get it.
I mean, hoarderism wasn't a thing that, you know, you and I heard about.
No,
that
was the cool guy's house. Growing up in San Francisco, if you knew a hoarder, you're like, wow, this is a lot of shit.
You've got issue 16 of Mad Magazine?
Yeah, exactly.
Dude.
So cool. Yeah, man. I'm bordering on hoarding in here.
No, my bookshelves are easily that cram packed with love. It's all good stuff. I mean, you know, it's all interesting.
Some of it, yeah, but how? But you probably read most of yours. I read some of mine.
I read some of mine. I actually don't think you need to read the whole book of anything except my books.
I mean, cultural criticism is, or criticism in general, that's always been one of the areas where, like, I think you make it very accessible.
Which I try. Well, yeah, no, it's not really accessible, but yeah.
It is accessible. Why do you keep saying that?
Well, I don't know. I think people, I was intimidated by it. Like, I didn't think I could just, you know, jump off the deep end and start reading, you know, Deleuze. And...
What did you understand, Deleuze?
I liked Deleuze very much, but, you know, I also cheated a lot. Like, I would sort of, you know, my introduction into a lot of critical thinking was by buying those for dummies or idiots, like,
sure,
comic books.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, this gave me some sort of solid, you know, ideas, and then I could go in
so you got the postmodernism for dummies?
Oh, absolutely. Foucault, you know, I could go read, you know, Capitalism and Schizophrenia and go, I kind of get it.
Yeah, I've got 1,000 Plateaus sitting over there. I've talked about it with 3 people that know that the book exists.
Like, I am never going to get through Kant. I'm never going to get through
Ulysses. You referred to it in the first 10 minutes.
I know, but that's the only part I know.
Oh.
That's like, I figure I just drop it in and then I sound smart. And see, like, this is what I mean by cheating.
Well, where'd you go to college?
I did not go
did
to
not
college.
Did not go at all?
Well, I don't know. I did a couple of semesters at San Francisco State where I did, like, Afro-Haitian dancing and marijuana selling, but I don't think that counts.
And then you started writing plays?
And then I started writing plays because I was with Dude Theater, which was a really weird, like, it was out of Club Foot, which was one of the old punk rock venues.
Where was that?
Way out on 3rd Street in San Francisco, like, you know, next to the old dockyards and stuff.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And, yeah, it was where, like, Sonic Youth used to play.
So. Right on, man.
And it was you know, before my time. But by the time I got there, it was a punk rock theater. And we did, like, garage theater.
Right.
With Dude. And I met Chris Brophy, who was one of the founders of Dude. By selling him marijuana at San Francisco State. And then he incorporated me into the fold. And then when Dude stopped casting me because I was too stoned, I started writing my own plays. I was like, fuck that. I'll cast myself.
And then you got some attention. Like, I remember, like, you were sort of like...
I won some awards and I did okay. Yeah, I mean, I wasn't making any money. But, you know, it's like I definitely got exploited by a number of institutions that I was very happy to be exploited by at the time.
Did your plays, like, travel? Did they make money? Are they done?
Are plays done? You mean, are they dead? Or
no,
have
they
I stopped
being
doing
done?
Them?
Are they?
Oh no, I had one play, like the last play that
did
I wrote.
Did French's publish any of them?
No, French, but I did get one published by like some weird other lesser play publishing outlet. But it was called Triple X Love Act.
Right.
Yeah, which I did at Magic Theater just because I hated the artistic director there so much that I wanted him to have to put that on the marquee.
yeah.
And that had some legs. I mean, I saw about 14 productions of that all over the United States and then decided finally that it was a terrible, terrible play because even the greatest production of I saw were John Cameron Mitchell and Fisher Stevens and all these great actors were in it. It was still bad, and I realized it was my fault. It was like, nah, it's just the writing, man. There's no there.
Well, you don't have to tell them that. They're actors.
Well, I had to figure that out. You know, it's
what was it about?
Oh, it's about the Mitchell brothers. Remember the Mitchell brothers? Yeah, they ran this sex emporium.
I have a beautiful poster. Didn't you see that poster in the bathroom?
No, I didn't.
You didn't even notice.
I didn't, but I'm going to have to go back and look. That was what the play was about. My play was about the Mitchell brothers' murder.
Didn't they try to make a movie of that once?
Yeah, I was called into a million little weird...
Independent film groups
yeah. Where like, and I met with Sean Penn and stuff like that about it. And then I think Emilio Estevez and Charlie Sheen ended up doing something called X-Rated.
Yeah.
Which had nothing to do with.
So your play was based on that, their relationship and the murder?
My play was based on the Emilio Estevez vehicle. Yes,
that's interesting.
No, it wasn't. Yeah, it was actually based on the.
No, but I have a casting poster. Like that was put up like on telephone poles. Casting Mitchell Brothers now casting for 1973 film production.
Get out.
Yeah,
really?
It's a silk screen.
That place is legendary. You know that Hunter S. Thompson was like the alleged night manager there.
We had a business card. I think someone I know has a business card of Hunter's from when he was doing that job.
That's just hilarious. I mean, he was basically just drunk, you know, there.
It's sad because you used to see him like at Tosca and shit. Like he was. Did he influence you at all?
Oh, utterly and completely. Well,
the
name
fuck.
Of my new book is Fear and Clothing.
I guess that's true. Sorry. That's a dumb question. I'm an idiot.
No, you're not.
But like his essays, the way like he was very succinct, man. Very funny.
When I was in 8th grade, I have to thank you, Tim Madison, wherever you are. the stonedest boy in my eighth grade, when I was a completely unsuspecting larva of a blonde person, walked up to me after lunch one time, and his eyes were spinning, and he opened Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and he said, "We were halfway to Barstow when the drugs kicked in." And he basically read me the whole first page, and I just kind of stared at him open-mouthed for a minute, and he just kind of nodded at me and went, "Yeah." You know, and it was, and I have to say, I was intrigued. You know, I went, I got the book, and it was all over for me from that point on.
Great, right? So that was the brain changer.
That, and there is an issue, and actually, one of my dear friends is Ted Mann. Do you know Ted Mann?
Uh-uh.
He was an editor at National Lampoon, and then he went on to write a bunch of, like, he went Deadwood, he wrote Hatfields and McCoys, yeah. He's writing on.
I liked Hatfields and McCoys, actually.
He's a brilliant writer.
Like, I don't know, that movie, like, it was on the History Channel or something.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I ended up watching it one night. I'm like, wow, this is a real movie.
Well, the greatest thing that, I mean, for me, the biggest influencing thing that Ted ever did was in 1982 when I was working at a 7-Eleven.
Yeah.
He wrote The Utterly Monstrous Mind-Roasting Summer of O.C.
and
Stiggs.
Great.
O.C. and Stiggs.
Great.
He and
That's
Todd Carroll wrote that. I'm sorry, I'm bellowing into
the mic,
but I'm so enthusiastic. I mean, I
remember that too when I was reading Lampoon.
I
what the fuck?
I coveted that thing. I had this dog-eared copy of it that, like, it was so, like, the edges were frayed because I read it so many times. I mean, I have pages of that thing memorized. I used to Xerox it off page by page and give it to people for Christmas if I really loved them. Like, that's what I gave my mom one year. definitely.
So those
Ted and Hunter, man.
Fear and Loathing and O.C. and Stiggs, Great Adventure.
And I also read some, you know, Dostoevsky and shit.
Sure.
But those aren't as fun to talk about. John Fonte.
Yeah, not as funny.
Ted Mann. And
Ted Mann, though. Like, I think that was probably the last time that Lampoon was good, like around then.
Yeah, pretty much 82. Yeah, you got to kind of go backwards on that.
Yeah, right?
Right after 9/11, like, everybody was freaking out and buying cans of tuna fish and stuff. I basically got on eBay and bought all the old National Lampoons
from
that 71.
I could get.
Because I thought, if I'm going to die, that's what I want. I want to be. I want to get killed while reading National Lampoon magazine.
Did you see the doc?
Golden Age. No, I needed to.
It's brand new. I think it just came out. Like, I got a screener in there. It was great. I like a lot of shit I didn't know. It was really great about Lampoon, about the whole history of it.
I'm dying to see.
I still have a resentment against my. Like, I had a second cousin who lived in Cambridge. Jane and Jim, my father's cousin Jane, who I used to stay with a lot, and they were older, right? And he had the first, like, 3 or 4 years of the Lampoons in binders, like, starting at episode one. And I was always like, God, you got to give those to me if you ever want to get rid of them. And he never did. And one time I was at this bookstore in Boston, a used bookstore. It was on, like, Newbury Street. And I saw those ones out of the binder with his name on it.
Get the heck out.
He just went and fucking got rid of them.
Oh, that is, you know what? That's a relative to never speak to again.
Almost, right?
Yeah, no, that's a crime.
God, they were so good, man.
Yeah, I hate that. That makes me angry. And also, some motherfucker, and I'm going to dedicate my life to hunting them down and killing them.
Yeah.
Like, in the New York Public Library, they actually have binders with a complete set of National Lampoons.
Yeah.
And somebody stole the second one, where, like, it was the good years. They stole the 70s. Those bastards.
Gone.
Like, somebody just pimped it.
So let's go. Let's go state for state. What'd you learn?
Oh, God. I mean, it's like,
was your thesis confirmed?
Very much so. Yeah, to the point where I kind of went crazy. You know, when you, like, learn too much too fast and you kind of start babbling in inchoate sentences, your agent starts worrying about you and stuff. That was me for quite a while. Yeah, I was looking at codes, fashion codes, like, trying to be extremely reductivist and sort of figure out, like, what is the code of this region? So, like, I went to Washington, D.C., where everybody's freakishly conservative all the time because sartorially, you know, in terms of their dress, they just don't want to tell you anything about themselves because they want to be this blank canvas for you to project power fantasies on you.
Right.
So, like, they just wear the same, like, Brooks Brothers suit and Ann Taylor loft, you know, corporate Secretary Burka office wear.
Yeah.
For, you know, and it's expensive, but not too expensive.
Right.
You know, it's
practical.
Fitted, but not too fitted. You
right.
know, it's, like, not dowdy, but not revealing. I mean, there's this really absolutely invisible tightrope that that DC fashion is, and so it's deliberately boring, so it deliberately tells you nothing about, you know, because if you look at people on the street, you can say, you can extrapolate a lot by looking at them. You can say, yes, you are sexually active. Yes, you have a job that pays over $30,000 a year. Yes, you probably own a cat.
Can you? Oh, like 90% of the time or all the time?
I am pretty... I think that if you start looking at people with an eye to how much can I read about you and your life and your intelligence and how you want to be perceived and what you think your future looks like. I mean, I think you can pick a tremendous amount of that up.
If they're not just going to the store in their sweats.
Oh no! Even if they're going to the store in their
sweats.
Well,
you wrote this line, another underlined line in your book. We are all at our most psychologically naked when we have our most deliberately selected clothes on.
I think that's very, very true.
How, explain that to me.
Well, I mean, because we're always, you know, we're full of flaws as people and perceived flaws and things that we think are wrong with us or our bodies. And I think that, you know, where that becomes especially relevant to you is in your closet when you're getting dressed in the morning. And so you're going to dress defensively against all of your own perceived weaknesses, I think.
You know, I definitely do. But I do.
I wear all black all the time because I'm terrified of everything.
Really?
Like,
that's
the
choice?
Sure. I mean, it's like, I look all deathy, death goblin, death girl, because I'm really so wimpy and tender.
I've sort of leveled off on primarily plaid shirts, but I definitely have ones when I'm feeling fat and when I'm not feeling fat.
Oh, sure. No, I don't know if you noticed my drop crotch leather trowel right now, but damn, I'm just going to tell you, if you want to gain that extra 20, the drop crotch will serve you well. No one will ever know. They're like maternity pants for hipsters. Great.
The baby you're trying to hide is really just your incapable.
No one will ever
know. Your emotional stuffing.
It's my parasitic twin. Shut up.
So DC, that's what you learned there.
Oh, but I was trying to get, I took too long to get to the point.
No. Go ahead.
But I tried to get everything down to a fashion statement.
Right.
And to me, the fashion statement of Washington, D.C. was like a Freedom of Information Act document with all the relevant information blacked out.
Yeah.
So I decided that the D.C. fashion statement was redacted. It made sense.
That's a good metaphor.
Yeah, you know, yeah. I mean, like where I went to South Beach for the first time, you know, and it's basically, isn't it great? I mean, it's like you're in the
I don't even know what's going on there.
It's ridiculous.
I can't, my mother lives in Hollywood, Florida, and you drive into South Beach, it's like, what country boom, are we boom, in? Boom, everywhere.
Boom, boom. Like chrome orange Maseratis, and everybody's just naked and in jewelry. It's like Rome. It's fantastic. So, yeah. So I like to say the fashion statement of Miami is a sext, which I think makes sense.
That's it? It's a sext.
Well, it's that short, you know? Yeah. It's like...
But it's also like the one thing I feel down there is, and in a lot of ways, because of what you're talking about, is someone, you're going there as a journalist or somebody's going to experience, whatever. But the weird thing is like, how do I interface with this?
Mm-hmm.
And there's definitely parts of the country where even though I'm not dressed in any way that definitive, but I don't know how to interface here. I don't know how to, in DC is one of them, South Beach, I'm like, I can't even begin a conversation here.
It was a very funny story. I went with a guy friend who was my photographer, Robert Brink, who does a lot of photography for skateboard magazines and stuff. And he's a good writer. He's been around a long time. And he went to be my photographer because I told him I want to go to game day at Ole Miss, because Ole Miss is where, you know, Hugh Hefner got all of his tall, ironed, blonde hair, butterscotch legged, you know, button nosed, ultra cheerleader,
right.
Gattaca, eugenics. And so he's like, yeah, I'm coming over there. So we went to Oxford, Mississippi, and we're looking at blondes, you know, wearing like these mini dresses with like that are of football jerseys with like the big padded shoulders and the number on them. And, we talked to some boys because the boys all dress like they're like 75-year-old Southern lawyers.
Right.
Like, you know, it's like
seersuckers and stuff.
Shorts. Yeah, very much like old gentlemen will.
Right. And polo and not afraid to wear pink.
And I was with Brink, who was dressed like more or less like you or I. Alternatively, he had like an army jacket and a plaid shirt on and maybe a pair of like skateboarding shoes. And they said, and they were very polite. You know, the Southern boys are very, very polite, but they said, they broke it to him very gently that he would not get any suction in the lady area in around Ole Miss with right. the outfit that he had on and that yeah. he would be recommended to the alternative bar, which they took to mean gay. And it was like, and they said, yes, one of the guys was like, I definitely had to change my style into much more aggressive, preppy stylings because I look essentially like that guy when I got here.
But doesn't that have something to do with the, like in terms of the cultural critique that really has to do with almost planned marriaging.
That's exactly right. I mean, what they have to do is pollinate and give the children at Ole Miss are pollinating like
right.
enormous tropical flowers at each other, and the boys
the
are projecting bright polo colors of wealth and polo and lawns,
and they end up together.
They do. And then the girls go there looking for, and they're it's about mating, essentially, and
right,
wealth. It's
right.
about mating and wealth.
Aristocracy.
Yes, and in the South, they're very blatant about this, too. I mean, unlike the coasts.
Yeah.
I do find this to be a social difference.
But then what do you go with it then? But from there, you went, you did some work with the other side of the South, right? The more, not the other side of the South, but like more working class, more... camouflage wearing. I mean,
wait. Oh yeah, no, you're talking about. Well, actually, that was in Kansas.
But still, like, but there is that class. There is a code that, because in the South, I mean, you have that Southern aristocracy, but you've got plenty of what I imagine that class of person thinks is hill people and peasants.
Oh, sure, yeah, exactly.
And they have their own codes as well.
Oh, sure, the backward people.
Sure,
you know,
that's what hipsters aspire to.
Exactly.
We want our beards and we want to, you know, pickle things.
But I mean, fashion is very tribal. Mm-hmm. It's very tribal and it's very referential to its own, you know, 3-block radius, I think, in a lot of ways, or, you know, your group of friends.
Well, what happened in Kansas?
Oh, I thought you were referring to this passage about Cabela's. Have you ever been to Cabela's? That's more like hunting fashion. You said camo.
Yeah.
So I thought because it is like camo Disney. It's sort of like if Disneyland was devoted totally to stalking, killing, and eating large game animals in various shades of camouflage and like ghillie suits with like duck blinds and like, you know, incredible like gauge weapons and then meat slicers in another section and also taxidermy that is like it rivals the New York Natural History Museum in terms of quantities of taxidermy, but it's all staged in these ways that it's like this Hobbesian war of all against all, like where like, you know, cheetahs are jumping over, you know, the gun rack to attack a zebra who is then kicking the face of a lion at the same time. And then as a bunch of wildebeest are like coming down like a shale mountain that's so steep that they're all crashing.
And this is in private homes?
Ground. Oh, no, this is in this enormous, like if you took 8 Costcos and then had it run by a secessionist group of people who hate animals with a lot of artillery, then that would, and then put a natural history museum that was full of agony and killing.
And that was in Kansas?
That's in Kansas.
What's it called?
Cabela's, man. No, it's really a sight to see. It's an awesome American wonder. There's even a log cabin hotel next to it with its own water slide.
Oh, so yeah. You got everything for the family?
People come from out of town. I mean, it is
sure.
a real destination.
Yeah.
Death paradise. Yeah.
I went to the Creationist Museum in Petersboro. What is it? In Kentucky.
Was Jesus riding a dinosaur?
Sure. Yeah, they got that kind of stuff.
No way.
Well, Adam and Eve was like, they were quietly sort of like sitting with dinosaurs.
Just, you know, coexisting.
Yeah, just right there.
Before
there's
the shame.
There's a dinosaur eating some flowers and Adam and Eve.
Before we discovered we had genitals, we could hang out with pterodactyls.
Yeah.
It was all good.
we ruined everything. God, we could have been a
man.
Perfect world.
Original sin.
Where else did you go?
Oh, let's see. I went to Savannah. I went to Alaska.
Oh, I lived in Alaska for 2 years.
God,
when I was a kid.
You did? Really?
My dad was in the service.
Oh, okay.
69-71.
That makes sense. Were you like over in Seward or
Anchorage?
Anchorage, sure.
What was that base called? There was a fuck. I don't remember.
Was he spooky? Your dad?
No. He just he went in as a after medical school, like he could enlist as an officer to finish out. I think his residency.
It was like a ROTC thing.
Yeah, kind of. Like he just like at that time he could have gotten drafted. He might have gotten drafted. I don't remember. But if you were a doctor.
Yeah.
He was a major. He went in as a major and he was stateside in Alaska.
Yeah. It's not a bad place to be stationed from what I understand.
Well, I remember it having a profound impact on my brain, just the space
because
up there.
Because of all the snowmobile fumes that you huffed with the Inuit children.
A lot of snowmobiles. And I just remember there was wreckage on the inlet from the 63 earthquake.
Good God.
And there was and everything was so gray up there all the time, it felt
it's
like.
It's so gray. Isn't it a strange place? And it's interesting to me that Alaska is like one of the stabbing capitals of the world.
Really?
Yeah. I heard that. I read it. And then you go into these gift stores and you see that they're selling all these like walrus bone, like shark murdering knives, people just carry around with them.
Or to gut a seal with.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's like, well, if you need to kill the seal today, then, we've got the nice scrimshaw knife for you to do that with. With the scissor teeth.
That's what people are getting stabbed with, those kind of things?
I guess. I mean, I don't know. I heard that a lot of people got stabbed there because people carry knives.
Yeah.
Fashion-wise, it's fucking cold and people dress warmly. I mean, it wasn't, it's like, it was sort of a moot point, the fashion of Alaska. I mean, because it's very much dressing not to die from freezing.
Yeah.
And which just looks, very similar to other parts of the
heavy
country.
Heavy layered.
Like, Jackson, Wyoming, not dissimilar.
Yeah. Just layering out of necessity.
Bunch of polar fleece layers. Yeah, yes. Yeah. And then.
Did you do New England?
Where did I go? Well, I mean, sort of talked about a little bit about Rhode Island and Connecticut and things. I mean, I was there. There's a lot of places that I went that I didn't spend a whole lot of time writing about. I was trying to kind of, because I had to finance all of these travels myself. I didn't get a big enough book advance to actually do it right.
Right.
So I had to sort of pick my battles. But sure, New England, I mean, yeah, what they call the cardiac belt, because for some reason, I divided all of the regions into belts because it's about fashion. Get it? Belts.
Yeah, got
belt
it.
Regions. That's apparently the cardiac belt. It's where if you go from Maine essentially to Connecticut, that's where like all the white men eat too much pork.
Is that true?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. Or pot roast or something. I'm not sure what they're doing wrong, but they have a lot of strokes.
Uh-huh. I liked Maine. I liked. I liked the country up there. I spent a lot of time in New England. I like layering.
Yeah, I do too. I like layering, and it's always nice to get that sort of Pantone shades of muted, faded t-shirts going on, where you got the ochre t-shirt and then the faded burgundy t-shirt.
Yeah.
And then you put the really nice kind of matching clashing plaid
tweed.
Over that.
Little tweed.
Bald corduroy. Mm, yeah.
Like
yeah,
corduroy.
Corduroy with the knees blown out.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Kind of like hip professorial.
Yeah, exactly.
I was going
John Cheever goes duck hunting kind of thing. Yeah,
I was doing that for a while.
Going duck hunting with John Cheever?
No, just dressing like that. I'm big on corduroy. I'm so excited to cool down here so I can wear my new Filson wear.
So you had a tweedy period, are you telling me?
I'm still, I'm definitely a corduroy. I'm still kind of in corduroy.
I have to say, one of the times I ran into you on the street in Soho, and you looked very, very dashing. You were on your way to some important meeting. You had a very elegant tweed jacket on and a colorful scarf.
Oh, I like scarves.
And I thought, wow, Mark's wearing a colorful scarf. He must be successful.
I don't know. I think I was affected.
No, you looked happy. I knew you were on a good trajectory.
Well, I like overcoats and I like scarves.
Overcoats are good.
Yeah.
I want to see your return to the say anything overcoat.
What's that?
You remember the say anything. Your eyes, the light, the heat.
Yeah, yeah.
Where all the people in high school wore those kind of really shapeless, large sort of overcoats.
I love those.
Because
you get them at thrift stores.
Exactly.
You get huge old overcoats.
You can't find them anymore, but they were a great thing.
You know where you can get stuff like that, for pretty cheap, is in places where they don't, if you go to a Nordstrom Rack in a place that's hot all year round.
It's true.
That's where you can find the good overcoats.
But you cannot find them in Gabardine.
Mm.
And a really good overcoat should be Gabardine.
Is that true?
Hello, Gabardine.
I can't dress in fancy clothes because I sweat a lot and I just destroy clothing.
Oh, Gabardine is made for sweaty 50s businessmen. It's ideal. It's like what rodeo stars wore and stuff. I mean, it's just like that really thick, beautiful weave that's got what is it, cotton and rayon or something like that. But Gabardine was just when you see those really tightly, it's like the 1,000 thread count sheet set of Eisenhower jacket collection.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, I know exactly. you're talking about those Ike waistcoats that are in that thick military issue.
What, before Fonzie wore a leather jacket,
right?
He wore that sort of white Eisenhower jacket.
Yeah. I used to love those.
Those are, and if they had slightly padded shoulders because they were from like the 40s
Holy
or the
shit.
Early 50s, that would be a gabardine jacket.
Well, I used to like those military waistcoats.
Oh, yes.
So I don't remember. I had a couple of those. I can't remember how old I was, but that was a thing.
You wear a military waistcoat with drop crotch pants, you can gain 30 pounds and no one will know. I'm here to tell you.
I got a plan. So, like, okay, so after all of this, what kind of closure did you get for your thesis and also with yourself and with your parents?
And America?
And
you
America.
Mean all of my problems? Well, how did it all roll
isn't
up?
Isn't that what you set out to do with Cultural Crit? Is like come, you know, come at, arrive at something
I'm
where you're like.
I have meaning.
Yeah. Meaning. I've got it all.
Now I understand.
Everything.
Everything. I'm insufferable. I can't talk to anybody but you now. But like, no, I got very, it was a complicated journey for me, but basically it was kind of about don't be tyrannized by fashion or any other form of social brainwashing. Sort of know how they're doing it, know who's doing it to you, and know what it looks like. You know, like I always like to say that like a Louis Vuitton bag is absolutely meaningless as a fashion statement because it's so pervasive. The only thing that it's declaring is it's not an act of individuality. It's a statement of your tax bracket.
Right.
It's a separation of your economic condition from everybody who can't afford a Louis Vuitton bag. You
right.
know? And
most of them are fake anyways.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's ridiculous. I don't think
go to 14th Street.
It's gang colors. I mean, yeah. It's sort of like it's just saying fuck you, you're poor, and I'm not. And so,
gang
like,
colors for people with doormen.
Yeah, and it's you know it's kind of tasteless in that respect because it's not saying anything else.
I never got it.
And so you know, and I am all for you know if somebody's got their old grandmother's Louis Vuitton bag or like you know it's always hilarious to see kids in their grandpa's Gucci slippers or something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I love all that stuff as long as it's got some personal resonance for you. I don't care whose label is on it.
Sure.
I mean, from Payless Shoe Source. To you know, Louis Vuitton, who is essentially the pole star of human fashion evil.
Yeah.
I mean, like it's all fine, you know.
Just as long as you know why you have it.
As long as it's meaningful to you,
yeah,
and actually says something about you, and
yeah.
I think that you know. Most of American capitalism seeks to hide you from yourself and your community and
your
fellow
desires.
Man. Yeah, I mean, it's like it's about making you an isolated consumer who feels like, oh, but if I had, you know, those other pants, people would like me more. And
you don't, but see, it's weird because you don't really realize that happens until everyone's wearing it. And it's like the idea that this brainwashing goes on and capitalism, on, you know, is in. It's part of its agenda and it's part of its consciousness, but it's just the rules of the game. But you somehow like people like me, you think, well, how could I be a victim to that? Because I live outside the box here.
You think you do,
but you don't. All of a sudden, like I'm buying records, and every fucking other idiot hipster is buying records. I don't know how that happens.
Oh my god! You know, well, the really scary thing that I found out just scared the shit out of me when I was reading Vance Packer because he's really talking about how motivational psychology that they apply in advertising. Treats the brain as three separate levels of consciousness. And like where there's the front of your brain, you know, where all your wordy, you know, stuff and all your consciousness is. And this is where you think you are. This
yeah.
is where you think you are. And this is like your superego. And
right.
this is where your motivations, you know what they are and you're willing to admit what they are.
Yeah.
And then there's a second level of motivation where you might sort of know what you want and why you're doing what you're doing, but you might not be willing to admit it to other people
mm-hmm.
because it might sound like you're a little bit selfish or, you know, gruesome
right.
in some way. It's you might feel like you have some ugly reasons for doing what you're doing. Then there's a third layer of consciousness, which is where all advertising and political campaigns are focused, which is into the back of your brain, which is where all bets are off. I mean, this is like straight to the id. This is why Sigmund Freud was terrified of all human beings for the rest of his life. I mean, like, this is where your motivations are so murky, you don't know what they are. And even if you did, you'd be so horrified by them, you would never admit them to yourself.
Right.
So that is where all the fun happens in terms of brainwashing.
And that's what they're trying to mine. That's like, we can guide that
they
force.
They know that so well, and they knew it in the 50s. They knew it in 1957. If they
just pull it through the other two. and make you buy the thing.
Oh my God, the things that they can implant into your brain now, I mean, it's beyond comprehension, really. I mean, it's like they have your number, they dial it repeatedly. They've Manchurian candidated everybody to a certain extent. I mean, to a large extent, to a huge extent. I don't think that anybody who grew up in America in the last 20 years has any idea how to live a human life, really. I mean,
we're just these robots?
There's that guy who died in a camper van, you know, out in Alaska. They made a movie about him. That was the only guy, I think.
Into the wild.
Yeah, exactly. I
mean, like, and he fucked up with a plant.
Yeah, you know, the mushroom killed
him. Didn't even have to die, that guy.
It was dignity, though. There was dignity in letting the mushroom kill him and not, you know, Iraq.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that there's
That's an optimistic, upbeat way to close this conversation. I love you.
I love you, too. It's
nice
always
to see
a great, deep pleasure to
It's
talk
a fun
to
book. Let's
Thank
sell
you.
Some. Fear and Clothing, Unbuckling American Style. Centra Wilson, the genius.
Oh!
Yes.
Yay!
Love her. I love Centra Wilson. Fucking great. Anyway, what else? This is it. The end of the show. Just remember, go to WTFpod.com for all that stuff. And go get Hal.fm if you want to hear all the archives and have them with you when you want them. How can I not find my pick?
Moin, wir sind die Footballerei. Ich bin Kutsche.
Ich bin Flo.
Und ich bin Daniel.
Wir sind aber noch viele mehr. In der Footballerei gibt es American Football Freischnauze, überwiegend die NFL, in ganz vielen verschiedenen Formaten. Da ist für alle was dabei.
Das Frühstücksei zum Beispiel gibt es jeden Montag ab 5 Uhr als Podcast. In der Saison natürlich mit den ersten Reaktionen auf die Spiele des Wochenendes und in der Offseason versorgen wir dich hier mit allen frischen News aus dem NFL-Kosmos.
Dazu gibt es die bunte Welt der NFL in Kutsches Zirkus, hochspannende Kriminalfälle bei Hall of Crime und das Thema der Woche während der Saison in der Footballerei. Show.
Also, wenn dich American Football fasziniert, wirst du die große Auswahl in der Footballerei lieben. Wir freuen uns auf dich.